going beyond statistics to make an emotional connection on the environment.
But we wanted to jump over these kinds of rational arguments and policy positions and go right to the emotional core of the brain and present a series of images to show what the Earth looks like, how the Earth is being transformed by 7.3 billion human beings and the way we have chosen to organize our economic activities.
That's Tom Butler of the Foundation for Deep Ecology. We talk with him about the gorgeous and disturbing new coffee table book of photojournalism, Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. And women mystery writers have gone from being ignored to being stars of the genre.
I think it's a direct outcome of the second wave feminism. You know, women were writing all along. And at 82, when I published my first book, Indemnity Only, that was kind of when second wave feminism had its most widespread support throughout the culture. And women were just hungry for believable characters that they could identify with.
That's acclaimed mystery writer Sarah Paretsky. We talk with her about women's changing position in the genre and about her own socially conscious mystery writing. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When it comes to environmental catastrophe, whether that means climate change, poisoned water, soil, and air, or a whole host of other massive environmental threats, there's one huge elephant in the room: overpopulation. According to Earth scientist James Lovelock, the carrying capacity of our Earth is about 2 billion people. We're on track to have 10 billion by mid-century. We're like Wile E. Coyote, who's already run off the cliff and just hasn't looked down yet to realize his predicament. We will either limit our families to a sustainable size, or we'll crash, like Wile E. Coyote. But few are paying attention. The population hockey stick curve continues to accelerate. Even China has ended its one-child policy. A new book and global campaign aim to end our complacency, not by citing the grim statistics, but by engaging our emotions. In more than 300 stunning photographs, ranging from the spectacular natural beauty we're losing to the shocking impact of humans on the planet, the book Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot, Over for short, illustrates the ecological and social tragedies of our ballooning numbers and consumption. The book is the centerpiece of the 2015 Global Population Speak Out campaign. It can be viewed online for free, and the campaign is giving away copies of the hardcover version to those who can show that they'll spread the word in their communities. I called up one of the authors, Tom Butler of the Foundation for Deep Ecology, to talk about the book. This is a really spectacular book, Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. Do you just call it over?
I do.
Okay.
It seems, well, if we do well in any awards category for this year, it will be in the most syllables in a three-word title category. Overdevelopment, overpopulation, overshoot is a lot of syllables for three words, and so I just typically refer to it as over.
Now, you work for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. You're their editor. Talk a little bit about the perspective that you brought to the creation of this book. I mean, we know it's part of a campaign, and we'll talk about that. But there's a lot more images than there is text. So talk about why this approach to have a book that's really a tabletop, spectacular photography book about these critical issues that we face as a planet.
Well, when we get to talking about how this book fits into the Global Population Speak Out campaign, I may speak a little bit more about the history of using large format books in environmental and social change campaigns, going back decades even to the pioneering work that the late David Brower did to fight dam proposals on the Colorado River and other things in the 1960s when he was running the Sierra Club. But in particular, with this project and with this topic, we made a conscious choice to jump over those kinds of rational arguments. There's no shortage. There have been hundreds or thousands of books and policy papers written on the global population trajectory in this huge crisis of global overpopulation. There's no shortage of that kind of information. But we wanted to jump over these kinds of rational arguments and policy positions and go right to the emotional core of the brain and present a series of images, very simply, to show what the Earth looks like, how the Earth is being transformed by 7.3 billion human beings and the way we have chosen to organize our economic activities.
And it is a real powerful punch. I mean, it combines amazing aesthetics. I mean, these are beautiful photographs, and their beauty delivers a powerful and extremely disturbing message, because you just cannot escape it. You tell a parable in the beginning of the book. What is that parable?
Well, it's a parable called Lord Man, and then it is repeated, or actually there's a redux, a kind of a concluding or a coda to the book, because the center of the book is a series of photo essays exploring, again, some of these ways that human numbers and human behavior is altering the Earth in different categories of activity. But I wanted to bracket those photo sequences, those photo essays, with a parable that would tell the history of humanity, well, history of the Earth and humans' emergence on the planet, and our movement from being part of the fabric of the community of life, a plain member and citizen of the biotic community was the way that the great conservationist Aldo Leopold phrased it, our movement from that position within the community of life to our position as assumed lord or sovereign over the rest of life. And so it was an interesting challenge to take a handful of images and just in very, very brief text and try to tell that story to set up the narrative. The phrase Lord Man, of course, with its gender exclusive language intentionally being evocative of a patriarchal attitude, an attitude of dominion and possession and control. That phrase, actually, I borrowed from John Muir. John Muir talked once about how if it came, using the phrase Lord Man, he talked about if it came to be a war between people and bears, he'd be tempted to side with the bears.
So give us a brief snapshot of what the overpopulation aspect means. I mean, you just mentioned 7.5 billion people. I've heard some estimates by, for example, James Lovelock, that the carrying capacity of the Earth is just 2 billion people. And yet, you reproduce a chart in the book that's one of those hockey stick graphs. Where are we going to be at the end of the century?
Well, no one knows exactly where we'll be, but the trends, the projections that the United Nations Population Division puts out show continued rapid increases, moving toward 10 billion by perhaps even as early as mid-century, if current trends don't change. That question, though, of where we're going in terms of the population trajectory is often discussed as one of, it's a fait accompli, that, you know, we're going toward 10 billion or we're going toward 11 billion. And in thinking about the production of this book and the associated campaign, we were very clear that the point should not be to assume that we're on that train and we have to get to that destination, because the reality is that a world of 7.3 billion currently is dramatically overpopulated. And there is tremendous suffering, both for non-human nature and for people, because of that rapid and huge growth of humanity over the last couple of centuries. To simply assume that we have to keep on that trajectory sort of takes away our desire to be active and to change that trajectory, because if there's one thing that should be clear to anybody who looks into the population question, is that this is a solvable issue. It's actually much more solvable than many of the other huge challenges facing humans and nature, including global climate change, the global extinction crisis as species are lost. These other major challenges facing humanity, including poverty and social inequity, really difficult. But to alter the population trajectory is actually fairly straightforward because we know it works. That is to say, if you elevate the status of women, you educate girls, and you make family planning tools and information universally available, birth rates come down, and they come down quickly. And that ultimately is good for people and good for nature.
And do we have time to do that? I mean, even if we could do that, say, within the next 10 years, would that make a difference?
It will make a huge difference. It potentially could make a huge difference globally, both at the and at the national level. But even let's assume for a second that it wouldn't alter the trajectory or we're on. Let's say that the patient's still going to die, but going to die slower. I hope that's not true. And here, when I'm referring to the patient, I'm talking about the Earth's ability to support humans and non-human nature. But the reality is that every family who is empowered to make choices and have smaller families and potentially have the wealth to educate all of their children and given the tools to space births and have the number of children they want when they want them, that's actually a victory for individuals and for dignity. And to me, that is a priceless thing and a very important thing, even if it didn't mean that we were going to save the Earth. Now, I tend to agree with the tagline of one population group that says single-child families will save humanity. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. That is the message that we should be sending, and we should be talking about this issue. That is really the key thing that we wanted to stress in this book, that here we have all of these global challenges. None of these things that we want to solve are going to be easier to solve if we keep adding millions and billions to the human family. All of them will be easier to solve if there are less of us, and there are humane, rights-based, culturally appropriate ways of reducing family size and getting that population trajectory going back the right way. So why wouldn't we do that? If we want to have a planet of life, of flourishing nature and vibrant human communities, why wouldn't we do that? The way to do it is to start talking about this issue.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tom Butler of the Foundation for Deep Ecology and for the campaign Global Population Speak Out. We're talking about the book Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. One of the many stunning photographs that you have in this book illustrates exactly what you're talking about. It's a photograph of two older men with two young female children. And the girls are child brides in Yemen. They are 8 years old. Talk about how this illustrates exactly the issue that you've just mentioned about girls. What is the birth rate in a place like Yemen?
I don't know what the fertility rate in Yemen is. I should know that statistic. I don't. What I can tell you is that every time I look at this image of these two young girls, both 8 years old, standing with men who appear to be three or four times older than them, it simply makes my blood run cold. And partly that may be because I'm the father of a young child, a girl, now a young teenager. And I know the contours of her life, and I know the hopes and dreams that her parents have for her. And we want a life for her of possibility and beauty and potential and joy. And I see these two young girls sold or given into marriage as children and know that they will not have that kind of life. They will not have autonomy and dignity and the ability to choose when they become mothers and how and how many children. They won't have the dignity to make fundamental choices that we would want for every human being. Now, in terms of the demographic trajectory, age of marriage actually has a huge demographic ramification. If a child, if a young girl is sold into marriage at 8 and becomes pregnant at 13 and begins having children, the amplification of population momentum grows. If age of marriage is delayed and people have the ability to space, to have the number of children they wish and space them accordingly, population momentum is going to slow. So there is this societal and global demographic consequence to early marriage and child marriage. But the horrific thing to me is the loss of potential and the loss of the chance of these children to achieve a beautiful life. It really is an image that I find extremely disturbing and very similar to some of the other images of nature. There's a second image in the book that is also extremely emotionally resonant with me. It's an underwater image of a shark caught in a net. To me, the same idea is represented in that image of the shark dead in a net, you know, essentially sacrificed to humans' desire to plunder and profit from the oceans. And these young girls, they both represent the idea of control, of dominion, of loss of beauty and loss of potential.
Another image that really caught my eye was of a surfer catching a wave filled with garbage. This is in the section of the book that's called Trashing the Planet. That's an amazing image. Talk about that image and what it says about what we're doing.
Yeah, that was an image captured in a bay, a surfing hotspot off of the coast of Indonesia, you know, which is, of course, a very, very populous nation. It is a shocking image. To me, that one was both really interesting because of its composition. It's whoever the photographer was, I've forgotten his name now, who caught that image, really was an amazingly skillful photographer. But the fact that here you have a person trying to recreate, is catching a wave, and it is literally, the waves are literally filled with the detritus of this global industrial growth civilization, the trash. And there are images sprinkled throughout the book like that, that are particularly provocative and notable. But I'll say something else about the team that helped assemble them and those of us who chose them and ended up sequencing these different photo essays. We sought not simply to choose the most outrageous example, the surfer catching a wave with garbage in it, or tar sands development in Alberta, a landscape what was once a formerly beautiful boreal forest in Canada, now turned into something like Mordor out of the Lord of the Rings for tar sands unconventional oil development. That is a particularly egregious example of a toxic energy economy. We also sought to represent and to find images that just show everyday life. What is it like for a person in India trying to get to work? What is it like for a person trying to commute through the clouds of air pollution in Beijing? And so we wanted to make sure that someone leafing through this book could see not just the most horrific examples of the way the Earth has been transformed and the loss of wild nature, the loss of other species, but also how that diminishes life and the character and the quality of life for people, just like us. Everyday individuals trying to get through their life and how this human overpopulation problem is directly related to all of us. None of us are exempt from it. The pollution that coal-burning power plants in China produce is emitted into the global atmosphere, and your child in wherever in the United States may breathe that. We're all connected.
We're talking with Tom Butler. He's with the Foundation for Deep Ecology, and he is part of a campaign, Global Population Speak Out, which has put out an amazing coffee table book called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. It has amazing photos of the Earth and what us humans are doing to it. Now, one issue that comes up, of course, you talk about growth. I mean, overdevelopment is about this kind of a notion that we can have endless growth without basically crashing the planet. So people often say, well, without growth, we don't have well-being. You know, how are we going to increase the wealth or the level, the standard of living of women who are having, you know, all these babies unless we have growth? What do you say to that?
Well, I'm tempted to borrow the old quip from Edward Abbey about growth for growth's sake is the ideology of the cancer cell. And it is actually a funny line, but it's an apt comparison. There's another quote by the late economist Kenneth Boulding, who said the only people who, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said the only people who believe in a perpetual endless growth on a finite planet are either madmen or economists. And he should have known, because he was an economist. This all goes to the point that this civil religion that essentially we have, that progress equals growth, is a huge and fundamental problem. It is a dominant ideology, but it doesn't correlate with the natural physical, biophysical limitations of the Earth. We know the planet is finite, it's bounded, its resources are not endless, and yet we have been inculcated with this notion that we can grow perpetually and that growth equals progress. So fighting that idea, which is a nonsensical one, is not necessarily an explicit part of this book, but it is something that I think most people will understand as they leaf through these images and these sequences. Growth, perpetual growth on a finite planet, is simply impossible. And the sooner that people undermine that idea that it is possible and that growth equals progress, the closer we will be toward creating steady state economies and moving toward a population level that is within the Earth's carrying capacity. And as part of that, we want to make sure that there's plenty of wild space for non-human nature to flourish. To me, this is a fundamental point as well, that those people who say, well, the Earth can support X billion or it can support Y billion, and they can throw out all kinds of different numbers, the key point is not to put necessarily a numerical target. If we are truly going to be ethical creatures as a species, we will want a population level that supports a high quality of life for our species while allowing all the other members of the biotic community to flourish. And as far as we know, the best scientific evidence suggests that roughly half the planet will need to be conserved for wild nature. That is, and this nature needs half idea is both ethically responsible and scientifically defensible. So we should be thinking about a population level that accomplishes that, that, you know, half for nature, half for people, and a flourishing civilization that's based on renewable resources and not the constant and perpetual degradation of biotic systems through the growth of the human population and consumption.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tom Butler of the Foundation for Deep Ecology and for the campaign Global Population Speak Out. We're talking about the book Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. So this campaign, Global Population Speak Out, of which this book is an important part, and by the way, I want to let our listeners know that they can read the book for free online. It's expensive to produce an actual print copy of the book, so if you just want to see these photographs, you can go online, and we will have a link to that on our website at writersvoice.net. Now, tell us more about the campaign. Is this the only kind of weapon in this campaign, or what other things are being done?
Well, no, there's a website, there are campaign videos, this is all at populationspeakout.org, campaign videos being produced in multiple languages, and there is a sort of innovative crowdsourced effort to distribute the book to opinion leaders and policymakers all around the Earth. So copies have been given and granted to NGOs in Europe, in Asia, in Australia, in South America, and in North America. And individuals can actually go online and apply to get a free copy and have one shipped to them if they have a creative idea for using it. So our colleagues, our friends at the Population Media Center and the Population Institute are the architects of this campaign, and they're doing a great job in thinking about innovative ways to get people talking about this issue, which is, you know, it's amazing to me. When we first started putting this book together, and we thought, well, population growth, this radical exponential growth in human numbers, human consumption, it drives all of these other factors. We talk about social inequity. We talk about the grave issues of poverty. We talk about climate chaos from our energy economy. We talk about extinction and biodiversity loss. And yet no one is talking in a rigorous and consistent and amplified way about the factor that drives or amplifies all these other issues. It's kind of shocking, really, and stunning. If let's say in your neighborhood, every night someone's house or building was bursting into flames and burning to the ground, and this happened night after night, and the community reaction was, well, this is a crisis. Our community is at threat. Our families are at risk, and so we need to respond. And they said, well, we must have more fire trucks and a bigger budget for the fire department. And other people argued, well, no. That may be part of it, but this is really an infrastructure problem. We need masonry buildings, not wood frame construction, and we need to change all the building codes. If that was the argument about the crisis facing your community, and no one would say, what's causing the fire? Is there a gas leak or is there an arsonist on the loose? We would think that was an absurd level of public discourse. And yet, essentially, that is the level of public discourse about all of these other global macro issues. If you talk about climate chaos, people say, well, give me some green energy. Put the solar panels on the roof. If you talk about the biodiversity crisis, people say we need more parks and protected areas, which is all true. All of those things are true. But if people are, even in the NGO community, if people are unwilling to talk about these fundamental drivers, the root causes of these issues, we will never ultimately solve them. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, population, this population crisis, is something that is solvable. We know how to do it, and it's not very expensive.
Right. And this is a very powerful way to get that message across. Tom Butler, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about the book, Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot, part of the Global Population Speak Out campaign. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Tom Butler is the Editorial Projects Director of the Foundation for Deep Ecology and the President of the Northeast Wilderness Trust. His books include Wildlands Philanthropy, Plundering Appalachia, Keeping the Wild, and Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth. You can view the book Over by going to writersvoice.net. You'll also find links there to the Global Population Speak Out campaign. Next up, this year marks the 70th anniversary of Mystery Writers of America, or MWA. We talk with MWA President Sarah Paretsky after the break. Stay with us.
Waving a flag for the set they claim, Democrat or Republican, Crip or Blood. You can switch it up, really it's all the same. Just corrupted agendas, a public offenders. They ain't come to defend us, government is against us. Working for corporate interests, we've been hoodwinked. They walking all over you with carbon footprints. But look man, we gotta find common ground, the common theme on which we gotta agree. We need the sea, we need the trees, we need the air, we got to breathe. Fossil fuels got us living like the dinosaurs, eating up the resources like a carnivore. What we need is a new energy solution before Mother Nature is the enemy. We shoot.
Turn it around, turn it for energy, like you can't see the sun.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When acclaimed writer Sarah Paretsky published her first mysteries back in the 1980s, few book reviewers took women mystery novelists seriously enough to even read their books, much less review them. Now, some 18 novels later, Paretsky is president of Mystery Writers of America, and women play a prominent role in the genre. Paretsky is credited with transforming the role and image of women in the crime novel, starting with the main character in her mysteries, private investigator V.I. Warshawski. The change didn't happen by accident. Paretsky and some of her fellow authors formed the organization Sisters in Crime in 1986 to support women mystery writers and advocate for better treatment by the genre's male-dominated institutions. Now, women are at the helm of MWA. In addition to Sarah Paretsky as president, women also hold the positions of vice president and secretary. This year marks the organization's 70th anniversary and the 69th year of the Edgar Awards. I spoke with President Sarah Paretsky a few weeks ago. Sarah Paretsky, I'm just thrilled to have you on Writer's Voice.
It's great to be here, Francesca. Thanks.
Now, the occasion of this interview is the upcoming, the 70th anniversary of the Mystery Writers of America and the 69th year of the Edgar Awards. Those are the mystery awards that honor the best in mystery fiction, among others. So you are the president of the Mystery Writers of America. Is that right?
It is, and I think it's a lot like being the Queen of England, except, of course, I don't have all the money and pictures and people bowing and curtsying. But the real work is done by the Executive Vice President, Donna Andrews. I'm just the public face of the organization.
Well, it seems that it really signals what's been happening in the mystery field. I mean, aside from Agatha Christie and P.D. James, I mean, for so many years, the genre was dominated by men, but that seems to have shifted, has it, in your experience as well?
Well, I think a big chunk of that shift came about when we started Sisters in Crime in 1986 in response to the real absence of women's voices in the mystery field, or at least voices that were being respected and taken seriously. And through Sisters, which started as an advocacy group to help raise the profile of women writers and get us review attention and things like that, the whole idea of what makes both a crime writer and a woman character in fiction has undergone a major sea change.
And you're credited with having something to do with that. When did you publish your first book?
A long time ago, 1982. Sue Grafton and I published our first books within 6 months of each other, and we were at a big crime convention in Long Beach last November, and we looked at each other and we just, how did we get to be the grand old doms of the mystery writing field? Because we could remember going to our first Edgar dinners, and people like Dorothy Salisbury Davis and Christina Brand, Dorothy B. Hughes, whom we greatly admired, they were the ones up on the dais running things. And we were like, how did we get to be Dorothy Hughes and Christina?
Now, one of the reasons I loved your mystery writing, and I think in some ways your work introduced me to mysteries, because it covered social issues that I have always been very interested and involved with. Do you think that the growing heft of women in the mystery movement had something to do with the women's liberation movement?
I think it's a direct outcome of the second wave feminism. You know, women were writing all along. Vera Caspary, for instance, who wrote Laura in 1942, great writer, great noir writer, but their names just didn't stay in the public mind, and people don't even realize there was a novel that the Preminger movie was based on. And I think 82, when I published my first book, Indemnity Only, that was kind of when second wave feminism was at its most widespread support throughout the culture, and women were just hungry for believable characters that they could identify with. So I think I could have been writing this in 1945. I could have written the same thing and had nobody pay attention to it. I just think women were ready, and then men also were ready to see women in new ways.
And Sisters in Crime, when did you begin that?
We began that in the fall of 1986. I had been hearing from a lot of women around the country about just frustration, partly with being disrespected at conventions where we were often segregated into a single panel of women writers. But a lot of it was very real career-killing stuff. Libraries are the main buyers of new and mid-list fiction. That's still true today and was even truer back before library budgets were cut to the bone. But they need to see reviews before they buy a book. And after we started Sisters and started doing some real data gathering, we found that a mystery by a man was 7 times more likely to be reviewed than a mystery by a woman. And this meant that books by women just were disappearing, and women's careers were disappearing with them. So that was the big thing that we did as Sisters, was start bringing books by women directly to the attention of libraries and booksellers and growing that market. We got a lot of flack in the early days. I got so much, people didn't write blogs, and it was pre-internet, but there were fanzines, and in the zine world, I was accused of everything from wanting to censor men and take all their books off the shelves to having a pointed nose and shifty eyes, which showed what an evil feminist I was.
And this pushback was coming from other mystery writers or from reviewers?
Coming primarily from mystery writers and also from reviewers and fans in the fanzines. And then a couple of years passed, and really it didn't take that long before everyone saw that what was really happening was that we were bringing new buyers into bookstores, that women who just had felt shut out from... we heard over and over from women readers saying, I gave up on mysteries after I outgrew Nancy Drew because I never could find characters that seemed real to me, women characters. And when bookstores would begin putting up a shelf of books by Sisters in Crime, and then they found the demand was such that they needed a whole wall of books, they weren't taking men away, but they were bringing a lot more buyers into the stores. And really, I think Sisters, maybe this sounds vain, but I think Sisters is responsible for the robust state of the crime and thriller market today.
And I said it myself at the top of this interview that you introduced me to mystery writing. I wasn't into Nancy Drew, so I think I should...
I wasn't either, actually. It sounds like heresy, but things came too easily to Nancy. I my heroines had to suffer before I liked them.
Do you think that women write mystery fiction differently than men do, or is that just too easy a comparison to make?
I don't think so. I'm sure that there's a difference in sensibility that's too subtle for me to figure out. There are a couple of guys who I think write wonderfully about women. Both English writers, one Peter Dickinson and the other Peter Lovesey. I think we all write out of our fantasies, our wishes, our fears. And so the more empathy you have with both yourself and with the people around you, the more realistic your characters of both sexes are going to be. And there have been all these studies of, you put the names of different sex persons on a manuscript, and really the reader believes it's the sex of the person whose name is on the manuscript. I think the only time that I ever was taken aback by this was a crime writer male crime writer. I read his first mystery, and I thought, this has to be a woman. And it turned out that it was someone who'd had a sex change operation.
Wow.
From woman to male. So he understood both points of view perfectly.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with mystery writer Sarah Paretsky about the influence of women writers in the genre. She's the president of Mystery Writers of America and is famous for her mysteries featuring the female private investigator, V.I. Warshawski. Now, the other whole issue that I mentioned before, I brought up, is that a lot of your fiction takes up social issues. And of course, you're not alone in this, but it is kind of, I think in some ways, a subgenre. I mean, I think of Archer Mayer, who also does that. And you know, there are definitely other mystery writers. Tony Hillerman talked about the Navajo. Could you talk a little bit about how you use mystery fiction to explore social issues?
Well, mysteries, in a way, are the perfect intersection of law and justice and society. And it isn't something that I set out to do consciously. What I set out to do consciously was to write about white-collar crime, because when I started, I have an MBA in finance from the University of Chicago, and when I was first writing, I worked for a multinational insurance company. And so I was seeing, not that as far as I know my company was committing white-collar crime, but our claims people were certainly investigating a lot of white-collar crime. And I began thinking that the damage done by white-collar crime was much wider-reaching than street crime. Street crime, somebody is shot and killed, it's terrible, and it destroys families, and I don't want to understate that. But somebody who's deliberately swindling large numbers of bank customers out of their life savings, as Charles Keating did during the savings and loan scandal, for instance, or deliberately withholding information about the dangers of asbestos from hundreds of thousands of miners, as the Johns Manville company did. They're killing on such a grand scale and destroying so many lives that it just seemed to me that it was a field that really needed to be mined. Well, can you mine a field? A field that really needed to be plowed, explored. And I think that the issues of social justice fall in a way automatically in the wake of that.
Have you, and I confess if I don't know the answer to this, have you taken up the issue of mass incarceration? Because, of course, that's so much linked to crime and the way we treat crime in this country.
I haven't taken up the issue of mass incarceration, but I have a couple of books that are set around issues, around prison issues. One of them is Hard Time, in which VI ends up in a prison, a for-profit prison, which is one of the many horrible things that I think that we do. We run prisons for profit, and they're treated like hotels. Filling beds is really crucial. And so there's a real push that comes from the private sector for incarceration. So my book, Hard Time, dealt with that. And then in another book, Hardball, too many hards there, but Hardball, I looked at, Chicago had a, well, may still be going on, but for 20 years, one of our police area, big areas, there's five police areas that cover the city, and the area two that covers the predominantly African-American South Side, was running quite openly a torture ring to coerce confessions out of people. And despite many, many efforts by lawyers, by the county medical examiner, and to bring this to the state's attorney's attention, the torture was allowed to continue. And it makes me just weep every time I think about it. But anyway, my book, Hardball, looks at that.
And when did that come out?
That came out, I didn't realize this was going to be on the test.
Oh, you don't have to say.
Around 2005, maybe.
So the reason I ask that is, this has been in the news recently.
Yes, it turns out that there's yet another, 2009 it was published. It turns out that although the Area 2 torture ring was shut down, maybe around the year 2000, the police have been using a much more secret location on the near west side of Chicago. And the Guardian newspaper in London is actually the news outlet that broke this story. I don't know. It's so hard. And I think as a vulnerable citizen who was scared about crime, I sit exactly on the fence. I want the police to protect me personally from street crime, and yet there's so many false arrests and torture and so on. It's so horrific. And of course, the publicity around Ferguson and all the other shootings of African Americans on the streets and the racist language in the emails, it just feels like we've created, well, as the Cat in the Hat said, this mess is so wide and so deep and so tall, I cannot clean it up. No, I cannot at all.
Now, back to the Mystery Writers of America. Sarah Paretsky, you said before that you had been, you know, you'd gotten a lot of flack when you first started writing, and that things shifted when it showed that there was a huge female market for mystery fiction. What about now? Where is the kind of the institutional structure of mystery writers, as in the Mystery Writers of America and the Edgar Awards? Where is it now in terms of its the approach to women?
I think it's a very shifting landscape, and it's hard for me to evaluate. I don't have numbers, and I don't have ways of getting numbers the way that it was easy, relatively easy, back when it was a print-only world. But now with so much internet publishing and so on, it's hard to get a clear picture. But these are things that have changed, and not, in my opinion, for the better. When I started, there might have been 50 or 60 independent trade publishers in New York. There are five now.
Wow.
So individual writers have many fewer options and opportunities for publication than existed 30 years ago when I was starting. Another big change that has come about as a result of conglomeration is the move to what I think of as the star system. You got big movie houses like Sony, Disney, Warner Brothers involved in publishing, and they saw this through the movie lens. You have a big bankable star, and then the rest of your movies make money as people want to see the big bankable star. So they started paying advances. People like Mary Higgins Clark, John Grisham, Patricia Cornwell started getting advances of $8 to $12 million a book.
Oh.
As opposed to, and when I started, you know, a nice advance was $50,000. And publishing isn't elastic. There's no way to make up that money. And so money has disappeared from supporting mid-list writers and new writers because all the money gets sucked into supporting the stars who are getting these huge advances. And so at the top, when you look at the stars, the list leaders, the people who are making huge amounts of money, you'll see a lot of women, Patricia Cornwell and Sue Grafton and Gillian Flynn. And so it looks as though women are, you know, fat, dumb, and happy. But when you go back to the mid-list, you'll see that women are the ones whose contracts, print contracts, are being dropped in much bigger numbers than men's. I can't verify that with data the way I used to be able to, but anecdotally, that seems to be the case. And then for writers of color, especially African-American writers, the picture becomes even bleaker. So, for example, there's a African-American writer named Angela Henry who used to keep a blog for black crime writers. And as I was trying to get data for MWA on diversity, I contacted her because I couldn't find these writers online, and she said no, they'd all been dropped. She discontinued her blog because they had all lost their contracts. We're talking about 20 or 25 people.
Oh my God.
So the picture is much, I think, much tougher for women in general, and tougher still for black women and for black men as well. Again, you know, you'll have a star like Walter Mosley, but yeah, I have one African-American friend who said she was turned down by St. Martin's because they were already publishing one black writer, and that was all their list could handle.
Oh, my God. It can't.
So this is the big challenge. When I didn't really want to be president of MWA, I'm kind of stretched past my limit these days. I'm cracking up. But this issue of diversity, I feel so intensely and passionately about that when it was presented to me, I thought, yeah, I'd better step up to this challenge.
Well, that was my next question then. Can organizations like MWA, Mystery Writers of America, shift this? Can they make a difference in opening up the field to more mid-list writers, women writers, and writers of color?
Well, it won't happen overnight, but I don't think I would be even mildly optimistic if I didn't have the history of what we did with Sisters in Crime. And what we did was not confrontational, because we need the industry, we need publishers, and, you know, editors are people who care as much about the printed word as writers do. They wouldn't be in a relatively poorly paid field if they didn't care about that. And I think of it as more an education and let's grow together kind of scenario. And what we did in the beginning with Sisters was through the hard work of people like Linda Grant and Carolyn Hart and Nancy Picard, Medora Sales, a bunch of people like that, we created a books in print that was a list of all of the women publishing mysteries, whether they belong to the organization or not. And we bypassed all the traditional review outlets, traditional books in print and all of that, and went directly to libraries, to bookstores. And that made a difference. And I think we can start trying to do that again, both for women, for writers of color. It's not going to be easy, but I think we can create avenues of public exposure and public education that will start making change, even if it isn't fast change.
And is there any way to deal with the star system and
I don't think there's any way to deal with the star system, because although as margins get smaller and smaller, of course, the stars are not getting those $12 million advances anymore, but they're still getting more than the rest of us.
Right.
But, you know, that's just life.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole push towards the devaluation of content in general.
Well, now you're touching on something that I'm both terrified of and also, again, feel passionately about. I think the Amazon model, for instance, is one that helps accelerate the absence of diverse voices. However much you can say, yes, you can self-publish on that platform and they'll do all these different things. The truth is, when you log in, they have an algorithm that presents to you what they want to sell to you. Beyond that, publishers actually pay Amazon for advertising, for getting a book promoted on the homepage. So a new writer who's on her own or his own, who doesn't have a big budget, they can't afford $20,000 to Amazon to have their book pimped when it's published. Sorry, I should have picked a different verb for.
I think that's a very descriptive word.
And, you know, one of the other things that has happened again with the star system is that the same books, the same writers end up, because they do get the bulk of the bucks and the publicity and so on, they're there all the time. And it may be that 2 million people bought The Da Vinci Code, or 10 million, or however many million did. And so you may say, oh, well, more books are being sold, but it's actually more copies are being sold of many fewer titles is what's really happening.
Well, time precludes us being able to continue this conversation at this time, but I look forward. Are you working on another book?
I am. I'll be publishing a new book July 28th. Which is sort of set in the world of corrupt Chicago politics, of which there's an unending supply. And I'm trying to start work on a new book that is against the backdrop of biological warfare.
Wow. Well, I would love to interview you about both of those books, certainly in July. So I look forward to talking with you then later in the season.
Well, thank you so much for your interest, Francesca, and for letting me rant, which I should learn to dial back. It makes me a very unattractive dinner table companion.
But a great interview.
Okay. All
right. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Acclaimed mystery writer Sarah Paretsky. The 2015 Edgar Awards will be presented in New York City on Wednesday, April 29th. Among the Pulitzer Prize winners named this week is environmental writer Elizabeth Colbert for her 2014 book, The Sixth Extinction. We aired our interview with her about the book last June. Here's a short excerpt talking about ocean acidification. Tell us about ocean acidification and why is it so dangerous?
Well, ocean acidification is sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, and I think that is a very good description. It's maybe even too kind, to be honest. Maybe it's even more evil twin. So what you need to know about ocean acidification, without getting into the complexities of ocean chemistry, is simply that carbon dioxide, when it dissolves in water, forms an acid, carbonic acid. It's a weak acid. You know, you drink it if you have a seltzer or a Coke or any kind of carbonated beverage, but it is an acid. And that changes the pH of the water, which has, you know, just a potentially vast number of knock-on effects. And when we burn, you know, gasoline or coal or oil, or natural gas, and we put carbon dioxide up into the air, a lot of that ends up in the water simply because of this exchange of gases that occurs at the surface of the oceans, and the oceans have a vast surface area, roughly 70% of the planet. So let's say about a third of our carbon dioxide emissions are ending up in the oceans in relatively short order, dissolving and forming an acid. So the pH of the oceans has already changed by a significant amount, and if we continue down this path that we're on now, they will change by an even more significant amount. And when you're a marine creature and your only interaction with the outside world is through the water, you know, it would be very much like changing the composition of the air for us. And if you change the composition of the air for us in a significant way, you could imagine that things would get pretty ugly.
Yeah, and you say that we are reaching what could be a tipping point by 2100. I mean, that's not very far away. And is this a process that we can even contain at this point?
You know, everything is dependent on whether we continue to pump CO2 into the atmosphere. You know, if we do, then ocean acidification is quite a predictable process. If you know that if you put up X amount of CO2, this is how much ocean chemistry is going to change. So that is really up to us. So when we say, well, there's a tipping point in the system, and in that case this refers to reaching this certain pH where it seems like a lot of creatures can no longer tolerate the ocean chemistry, beyond that, that is really still up to us whether we are going to reach that tipping point, whether we continue to emit CO2 to that point.
Elizabeth Colbert, speaking about her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction. Hear the whole interview at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.